happen, we have to really escalate the noise we make so that we'll be heard.
Welcome to Gay USA. I'm Andy Hum.
I'm Ann Northrup.
And we start off this semester with two Supreme Court justices saying they're ready to overturn the right of same-sex couples to marry.
Very scary in one way or another. So we are bringing on our guest, James Essex, director of the ACLU's LGBT and HIV project, to talk about that. And to talk about a landmark case, that another one that is going to be heard by the court on the day after the election. That's why they're so eager, one of the reasons, to get Amy Coney Barrett on the court.
A pro soccer team voted to forfeit a game after their out gay star was subjected to an anti-gay slur from an opponent.
We're going to show you the a lengthy statement by the coach that is so moving and so important. So make sure to stay tuned for that. Meanwhile, Governor Gavin Newsom has nominated the first out gay state high court justice in California history.
Horrible news from across the country for transgender women, setting records for murder, being murdered. We have reports from Philadelphia, Puerto Rico, and Georgia.
And on a lighter but still serious note, we'll show you who the real Proud Boys are.
And Belgium has given us the first transgender government minister in Europe. But we start with welcome, James Essex. Are you with us?
He'll be with us. Go ahead.
He'll be there. Well, this was the week that Kim Davis went to, her case got up to the U.S. Supreme Court. She's that Kentucky clerk who sued, had a lawsuit over how she was persecuted for being compelled to issue marriage licenses to gay couples. She got to court, and the Supreme Court, Justices Alito and Thomas, they said, well, this isn't a clean case, but we're very eager to overturn Obergefell. But this isn't a clean case, so we're not going to take her case. Do we have James with us?
Yes, he's there.
Okay, good. Okay.
Well, there.
Good. So, the court said, I mean, Alito and Thomas said that the Obergefell decision, which said that all the states have to do same-sex marriage, privileged a novel constitutional right over religious liberty, and the court created a problem that only the court can fix. Until then, Obergefell will continue to have ruinous consequences for religious liberty. How does that make you feel, James?
Well, not great. I share the concern that many folks have voiced over this kind of gratuitous statement by Justices Thomas and Alito about their displeasure with the Obergefell decision from 2015 and their worries about people of faith all across the country and what they're going to do. But now, so I am concerned about it. A lot of what has been said and talked about is people saying, well, look, this really points to the Supreme Court overturning Obergefell. And look, that's possible. The two of the five votes that went our way in Obergefell are no longer on the court. Justice Kennedy, who retired, and Justice Ginsburg, who unfortunately passed away, a month ago. And so we don't know how Justice Kavanaugh, who replaced Kennedy, or potentially Justice Barrett or someone else who will replace Justice Ginsburg, how they would vote on the issue, although we can all be a little worried about that. But the thing that I'm worried about is not so much that the court's actually going to overrule Obergefell directly, but instead that it's going to do other things. And I have in mind two different kinds of other things that they can do that will make serious problems for LGBTQ people and undermine our rights in serious ways. And those two things are religious exemptions and narrowing the scope of the marriage right in the first place.
So explain in more detail how those would play out.
What would it mean to narrow the right?
So let's take that one first. So narrowing the right. So right now, we have under Obergefell a fundamental right to marry. And I think built into that is the sense that, well, we, meaning same-sex couples, should get all the stuff that goes with a marriage when you get married under state law or you get married under federal law. And one way that I think that the court could try to undermine Obergefell and the freedom to marry is to say, okay, folks, you know what? Yeah, Obergefell gives you the license. You have a right to get the license, the piece of paper. But that doesn't mean that the state has to treat your marriages as real marriages or your marriages the same way the state treats other people's marriages. Let me give you two examples of what that might look like. There's litigation that is going on right now in the state of Texas that's related to the right to marry. And the city of Houston, like cities across the country, provides healthcare benefits to employees and to employees' spouses. And there's a group of folks who have sued the city of Houston and said, hold on a second, you're giving healthcare benefits to the same-sex spouses of city workers, and you shouldn't do that because the Texas Constitution says no marriage for gay people. And they say, even though the Supreme Court requires that Texas give these same-sex couples a license and say that they're married, you don't have to treat them that way. That's not what Obergefell requires. You're free to say, we're going to privilege straight people's marriages and give them health care benefits, and we're not going to give the health care benefits to...
How does that not run afoul of the Bostock decision, which was saying that the Civil Rights Act, now that was an employment case, that's sex discrimination. The only reason you're doing this is because there are different genders.
Yes, no, and I think that's a very good response. I think it does violate Bostock, and it does violate... So this would be... These are the employees, after all, and healthcare benefits are a kind of compensation. So I think that's one way to get at it. And it should be a righteous one because the federal law applies. The city of Houston certainly employs enough people that it's covered by Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 64. I also think it violates Obergefell. And by rights, the Supreme Court should be like, no, hold on a second. We said, you know, you get to get married, and that's not just a license. That means you're supposed to be treated the same. Because after all, Obergefell was in part about people who said, hey, you know, people who couldn't get birth certificates their names on the birth certificates of their kids, or their couldn't get recognized as married on the death certificates of their spouses who died. And so it's about, you know, being treated equally and having our marriages treated equally to the way straight folks' marriages were treated because of that recognition part of the cases that made up Obergefell. So that, too, by rights, the Supreme Court should say, all that kind of, you know, shenanigans around benefits that people in Texas are trying to engineer, that should violate Obergefell. My worry is that a future court will not see that.
Well, the court, as you say, in Obergefell, the court explicitly said all the rights of marriage. But we have had to litigate these things for the last 5 years since the Obergefell decision. Mm-hmm. We have had countless cases about parental rights and benefits and everything. And my general impression is that we've won all of those. Are there any that we have lost?
No, I think you're right. I think we have lost those, and so,
won them.
I think we have won all of them.
Yeah.
I misspoke. I think we have won all of them. And there was a case in the same genre as the healthcare case pending in Houston that came out of the state of Arkansas. And this was about birth certificates. When kids get adopted, many states, and Arkansas does this, will issue a new birth certificate for the kid that lists the adoptive parents' names. And obviously, the adoptive parents were not the birth parents. They're not the biological parents by definition, but the state will put the adoptive parents' names on the birth certificate. Arkansas said no when a same-sex couple asked to have their names put on the birth certificate of a kid who had been born in Arkansas, but who was adopted by this couple. And that case went to the high court in Arkansas, and Arkansas said, that's fine. Obergefell doesn't require us to provide equal treatment. The U.S. Supreme Court, and this is in 2016, so just a year after Obergefell comes out, summarily reverses the Arkansas Supreme Court and says, hold on a second, no. That's wrong. You have to treat this marriage of a same-sex couple from outside of Arkansas the same way you treat everybody else's marriages. But notably, there was a dissent in that case by three justices, Gorsuch, Alito, and Thomas, saying, no, that's wrong. And so they're at least starting, I don't think it was a particularly coherent opinion, but they're at least starting down the road of the Houston argument of saying, well, no, you get the license, but you don't. We don't have to treat you equally.
And Justice Alito and Thomas quoted Justice Roberts in his dissent in Obergefell. And we should say Jim Obergefell is a living person. We have a picture of him with his husband, John Arthur. They were, I believe, from Ohio, and they had to fly to Maryland to get married while John was very sick, but they did it, and he saw the case all the way through. And so that he is one of the community's heroes.
So ultimately, if they get, say, Kavanaugh and Barrett or Roberts, any two of those three, assuming Barrett is confirmed, we're really talking about them interpreting Obergefell differently or overturning it in this whole sense of a religious exemptions analysis. Yes?
Yes, no, so I think religious exemptions is the other way, and perhaps the primary way that the court can undermine both the right identified in Obergefell, but also a broader swath of and range of rights that LGBTQ people enjoy, both under the Constitution and under statutes.
And let's talk about religious exemptions, Gerald. But of course, nobody is ever trying to force the Catholic Church to do same-sex marriages or any church or religion that doesn't want to do them. But individual people who say, I don't like gay people, or I don't want to associate with this, or I can't do anything to support a same-sex marriage. You're even talking about people who work for the Social Security Administration saying, I don't want to process a claim by a gay couple because it's against my religion, which is insane, but that's what they want to do. And then, you know, the court sometimes says, well, you know, let that person then pass it off to someone else who'll take care of it. But of course, you're in parts of the country where there aren't other people to process things, like Kim Davis.
Yes, and Kim Davis is an example of that, where here we have a government employee. She was the clerk of the county with a bunch of different jobs, including issuing marriage licenses. And she just said, as a matter of conscience, she couldn't do this. And I think my answer is, like, unfortunately, that means that that's not a job, you know, that you can do. And look, freedom of religion is super important. It's a foundational value in the country. It's in the Constitution for a reason. It's protected by the Constitution, and it should be. But that freedom of religion doesn't give anybody the right to discriminate against other people.
Right. And of course, they can start also saying, well, why don't we get into the Fulton case?
Sure.
Because this raises all these issues. The city of Philadelphia says we've got an anti-discrimination law. It includes protections for LGBT people. It includes protections on the basis of religion. But some of the adoption agencies don't want to comply with that. A Catholic agency only wanting to do foster care for Catholics and nobody else, basically. And so the plaintiffs in this case are two African-American women who are Catholic, who say, you know, we want to work with Catholic social services. And how dare you say they shouldn't get city money to do a discriminatory function. So where are we with that? That's going before the court on November 4th. Who's arguing it for our side?
So two people are going to argue. Jeff Fisher from the Stanford Supreme Court Litigation Clinic, who represents the interveners, and the ACLU is also counsel there. And I'm blanking on his name. How can this happen?
Okay, keep going.
Representing the city of Philadelphia. So look, your summary of the case is right. I want to add and focus on one aspect of this, which is that, you know, this is not, you know, a situation where the city is trying to regulate a private agency that has nothing to do with the city. this is this is a city program that the city is regulating its own program, and it is hiring private agencies to do some work for the city, but it's the city's work. Why? Because it's the city's kids. These are kids that the city has taken out of families because of concerns about their safety, and then they're wards of the city, and the city has the obligation to find a place for them to live.
So the Catholic agency is saying, well, you know, but they actually are saying, we will refer you to one of the 29 agencies that will, you know, let gays have foster kids.
Yeah, and the city is saying, look, we want you to screen people. The city has hired this agency to screen prospective foster parents. And the state of Pennsylvania has a list of criteria that they're supposed to be using to screen them. Sexual orientation is not on the list. Why? Because it doesn't have anything to do with the ability of these people to be good foster parents. And so the city is simply saying, look, we want you to screen based on our criteria, not your religious test. And the agency says, no, we have a constitutional right to get this government contract in taxpayer dollars to perform a government service, but to use our religious criteria, not the government's own criteria. And that just illustrates, I think, you know, both why the city of Philadelphia is right here, but also why this case is such, you know, a step way beyond the arguments that were made in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case about a bakery that didn't want to sell a wedding cake to a same-sex couple a few years ago. This is not just about government regulating private businesses. This is whether the government can maintain control of its own services, its own work, or whether private entities that contract with the government can hijack that and inject their own religious tests into that. And if they can do it in this context, they can do it in lots of different contexts. So this case is not just about foster care. It's also about soup kitchens and homeless shelters and disaster relief services and on and on and on. Any government contractor, if Catholic Social Services in Fulton wins, will be able to alter the terms of government contracts by simply identifying a religious basis.
So you were one of the few people I knew who was, you know, optimistic that we could win Bostock, and we did. You saw where the votes were going to come from Justice Gorsuch. You held out hope for him. So what's going to happen? I know you don't make predictions, but I mean, what kind of arguments are going to work with these justices? I mean, could they go so far as to overturn Division versus Smith, which, you know, where Justice Scalia said, look, if laws are generally applicable, then it's not discrimination against religion.
Yeah, so wrapped up, you're right to raise the Employment Division versus Smith case. Wrapped up in Fulton is a question of whether the Supreme Court is going to sort of revise the way it approaches claims about religious free exercise and religious liberty in sort of whole scale. And there's a case from 1990 that Justice Scalia, no liberal there, authored that sort of made it harder for religious liberty claims to be heard by the court. And there's a bunch of thinking by academics thinking that, you know, the court may well change that. I don't know whether they're going to do that or not in this case. I think that they can easily decide the case without grappling with the Employment Division versus Smith question and set a question about how are religious liberty claims understood and how do they treated by the court. One of the reasons I think that the court may well not go there is that the Justice Department, which filed a brief in this case, not on our side, on the side of the Catholic Social Services, but they said nothing about Employment Division versus Smith. They simply said, look, you can decide this case without actually having to revisit Smith. I think that's a good indicator that even a very conservative Department of Justice under the Trump administration isn't asking the court to go that far.
But speaking of division, if they go this way, I mean, you know, they're going to further divide the country. Couldn't we form a religion that says we think Christianity is really evil and disgusting? That's our religion. And we don't want to serve those people anymore.
Well, you certainly could. And one of the things that, you know, it's striking about the Fulton situation and this issue more generally is that it's not just LGBTQ people who are being disadvantaged by these kinds of religious tests. There are cases pending in South Carolina where the federal government gave a waiver to the state of South Carolina to authorize it to give money to foster care agencies that discriminate in who they will work with. And it's not just LGBTQ people who were turned away. There's a Catholic woman by the name of Amy Madonna who was turned away from, she wanted to be a foster parent. And this agency said, no, you're not an evangelical Protestant. And so we won't work with you. There are also Jewish people who have been turned away by the same agency saying, you're not an evangelical Protestant. And so we won't work with you. So this isn't just about LGBTQ people. And it's not just about foster care. It's about government services writ large. And it's about whether discrimination will be constitutionally authorized, constitutionally licensed, and you know, licensed, authorized, you know, not and will be required for the states to allow this, not just against LGBTQ people, and not just based on religion, but based on race, and based on sex, and based on every other category that appears in our traditional civil rights laws.
And it's also about women's reproductive rights and health care and any number of things across the board. Is our remedy Congress and laws? What is our, how do we go about this?
Yeah, well, so I think, I mean, the challenge here, both in the religious exemptions context and also in the reproductive freedom context, is that the issues that the court may decide are constitutional, which means, you know, if the court comes out in Fulton or some other case that happens later, because there's a whole series of cases waiting in the wings, that, that the Constitution requires states to allow these exemptions. That's not something that Congress can overturn. We can't go to Congress and have a spiffy new law passed that says, no exemptions, because the Constitution trumps federal statutes. And so we've got not a whole lot of options here. And I think the main thing we need to do is talk about this publicly, which is why I'm so glad that you folks are giving airtime to this issue on your show, because we need people to understand just what's at stake here. People get it when you say, well, Obergefell might be overturned and that would be bad, because they understand that. When we start talking about all this religious exemption stuff, people's eyes glaze over. They're like, ugh, it seems complicated and seems like, oh, there should be a compromise in there somewhere. The problem is there really isn't much of a compromise here. Either the exemptions are constitutionally required, in which case I think every civil rights law in the country, whether it protects LGBTQ people or other folks, has a big hole blown in it. And that would be terrible for us and be terrible for the country.
And Justice Ginsburg said it would lead to marriage light. Well, James. So, I mean, and your analysis going into this in terms of, you know, since you gave us some hope for Bostock, how about this case?
So, look, I think by rights, our side, the city of Philadelphia, should prevail in Fulton. It is possible. I'm not saying sitting here predicting it, but it is entirely possible. And the way that could happen is the Chief Justice and perhaps someone other would say, okay, maybe I'm going to sign up for a religious exemption in some other context. But this context about government services, that's a step too far. The other possibility is this, that the Catholic Social Services wins in Fulton, but not based on this broad claim that there's a constitutional It's constitutionally based license to discriminate. Instead, the city of Philadelphia could win much the same way that the business won in Masterpiece Cake Shop. And that's this. In Masterpiece, the court said that the bakery won because a state agency, the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, while it was considering the claim of discrimination brought by the same-sex couple that was looking to buy the wedding cake, that Civil Rights Commission made statements that the court understood as anti-religion. And the court said, look, government's not supposed to be saying anti-religion things when it's deciding a case about discrimination. And so it said, because of that, the business won. There are allegations in the Fulton case that officials within the city of Philadelphia made statements that the court could consider, I don't consider, but the court could consider as anti-religion. And the court could decide that the case and say Catholic Social Services wins, but for that reason, not the broad constitutional license to discriminate reason. That's not a good ruling for us, but it does not have the broad sort of across the board terrible consequences that the broad ruling that Catholic Social Services is asking for in Fulton would have.
Well, we appreciate all you do. We also know that the ACLU, I just want to mention this because I got an email from your organization, ACLU.org. You're fighting to get the NCAA to get the March Madness college basketball playoffs out of Idaho because they have an anti-trans sports bill.
Yes, thank you for mentioning that. Absolutely. And it's not just a bill. The state passed a law last March. And we got it struck down by a federal court back in August. But that case is not at the end, and so the law could still survive. And yes, people should go to ACLU.org. There is a way that you could participate and lobby the members of the NCAA board, many of whom are presidents of universities that you may have gone to. And so go check it out and make your voice heard.
And they are meeting on October 28th, so do it now.
Wonderful.
Thank you, James. Thank you for the work you and your colleagues do, and thanks for keeping our viewers informed. We will continue paying attention.
Thank you.
Great to be with you both. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay. Well, we didn't ask James about Amy Coney Barrett because the ACLU doesn't have an official stand on her confirmation, but they do say it should not be taking place now. That is an official position that they have. So what a week. I mean, you know, we were probably one of the first people to point out that that was a super spreader event when they nominated her. Most of the infection.
I think we were one of the first, but go ahead.
Most of the infection seemed to be taking place inside the White House receptions. And it's what a week.
I would like to know what Melania's condition is. We haven't heard a word about her, only about her lying husband who's wheezing on the balcony. And I did appreciate one thing I heard, someone who said if Trump wants the full COVID experience, he should lose his job and his home.
Yeah. Well, of course, at that reception, I mean, you saw Tom Tillis, who does have the virus, confirmed, breathing all over the seven kids in very close contact. I mean, Amy.
And hugging people.
And we learned that Amy Coney Barrett had the infection in August. And what's her health condition? Why is the right wing sure they want to invest in this 48-year-old who may have long-term effects?
The assumption is she has antibodies and may have been the one person at the event who wasn't vulnerable to the virus.
But I mean, you know, Franklin Graham was there. We haven't heard about him. The head of the Alliance Defending Freedom, which Amy Coney Barrett has worked with, Michael Farris, was there. But Pastor Greg Laurie did get infected. And, Kellyanne Conway, Stephen Miller, that was a highlight of the week.
Stephen Miller was definitely a highlight. And also a highlight that Mary Trump is continuing her heroic work against the Trump administration in pointing out that, no, her sympathy is reserved for those who have become infected and died because of the malfeasance of the administration.
And although we respect Judge Barrett's freedom of religion, this People of Praise group, where she was a handmaid, literally classified as a handmaid, she has like family going back like two generations who are a big part of this organization. But, you know, they seem to be ashamed of her now. They are scrubbing her from the website.
They're not ashamed of her. They're just trying to get her confirmed.
It's for
this would be a good moment to also say to people, make sure you are registered to vote and that you go out and do it. The deadline in New York State is Friday. We are recording Wednesday afternoon. If you are seeing this by Friday and you are not registered, please register immediately.
And you still have time to fill out the census until the end of October because of court decisions that have extended it. All right.
Because we're recording on Wednesday afternoon, of course, we are not able to talk about the vice presidential debate taking place tonight as we record. But we are fascinated to hear that Pete Buttigieg was playing Mike Pence in Kamala Harris's preparations for the debate.
Now, was it because he's gay or because he worked in Indiana as a mayor?
Well, I think that understates his experience in Indiana. But yes, and there's a slight physical resemblance there, too. I'm sure he can play Mike Pence quite effectively. So good for them for figuring that out.
Well, what a week. Rick Wright, I think who is, we know is gay, right? The guy who worked at the NIH, who got marginalized in the administration, got fired from his job. He was the whistleblower at the NIH saying this, what they're doing is terrible. He has now resigned from the NIH. And his attorney said he can't sit idly by and work for an administration that ignores scientific expertise, et cetera. And now a former head of the CDC has called upon Dr. Redfield to come clean. You've got, the country is suffering and dying. You have got to come out and say what's happening. They will fire you, but that's how you have to do it.
I think we've all been calling for the entire administration to come clean for 4 years. It's a little late at this point. I'll take what I can get.
Well, these are dire times.
Shame on all of them for working for him for 4 years. Shame on them.
CNN put about 20 countries up today that had more infections and that had fewer infections this week than the White House.
Yes, exactly. By the way, a couple of things. We discussed last week the administration nefarious plan to get Trump elected by taking the election away from the voters and giving it to the appointed electors. They are appointed
by the state legislators. State legislatures.
And
they have that power.
State legislators who appoint the electors are Republican controlled in more states than than Democrats. But if we elect, if we flip some of those states in this election, we can have many of them take office before the deadline for picking the electors. Yes.
I thought that the plan was as soon as it, you know, they start counting all these mail-in ballots, to just seize the thing and say, this is a crap show. We have to step in and bring certainty here. So we're going to use our power under the Constitution to appoint the electors. The hell with the voters.
Well, yes, but the
right away after the election.
But the state legislators have to appoint the electors, and we can flip some of those legislatures from Republican to Democrat in time to have Democratic legislatures control the picking of electors.
I didn't follow that at all, because the electors meet in December.
Yes, and some of the new
January.
Some of the newly elected legislators
take office
in November.
Oh, good.
Yes. Not all. But
I watch this show.
The point is, don't just worry about the presidential election. Worry about the senators you're electing, the members of the House of Representatives, and your state legislators.
We have overcome lines for the House drawn by a lot of Republican legislators. That's how much people hate Trump. Republican legislatures drew these lines, and we overcame them. They were drawn for Republicans. But we have to do that in the state legislative seats. And, you know, it's only about flipping 7 or 8 seats in some cases in some states. And it's so essential. And, of course, Nancy Pelosi is saying we also got to elect some House members who are going to flip the state delegations if this goes to the House of Representatives. This is the madness that we're in.
Well, I'm heartened by the fact that so many people are trying to register in Florida that they crashed the system.
Yes.
The lines for early voting are enormous around the country. And as I suspected, millions and millions of people have just been sitting and waiting to get out and vote and get rid of these monsters. And we have to follow through and do that.
We're not going to get complacent. We're going to work to the very end. But Trump was, down 12 points in Pennsylvania, down 16 points nationally. That's kind of unprecedented.
Well,
all right.
National polls are not relevant, but the state polls.
If you're up more than 5 or 6 points, it's hard to overcome that in the Electoral College. That's the margin. And it's 16 points.
There's,
I think he's acting so crazy.
Exactly. Well, there's a new poll by GLAAD, our formerly known as the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. They hired a polling company to poll 800 LGBTQ voters. 76% for Biden, 17% for Trump. 88% of those polled are registered to vote, but that still leaves about 2 million unregistered LGBTQ people. Please.
Trump got 14% of the identifiable LGBT vote in the last election. He will get less this time. And that was the lowest percentage. 14 was the lowest percentage for a Republican ever.
We shall see.
All right.
Meanwhile, people are fighting back in Boulder, Colorado. They're fighting back against the Department of Housing and Urban Development's attempt to exempt homeless shelters from having to serve trans people in their lived gender identity. They have issued a declaration, shelters and organizations in Boulder, that they will respect trans people's gender identity in housing them in their facilities.
And gay men worldwide are fighting back against the Proud Boys, the group that President Trump refused to condemn in the last debate. And so what they're doing is they're posting proud pictures of themselves using the term hashtag Proud Boys, which is really upsetting the mean Proud Boys, saying it's a slur against them.
This lovely picture I hope we've showed or are showing of the Canadian military members kissing is just a stunning takeover of the Proud Boys hashtag.
And we've learned more about the disgustingness of the Trump administration. The head of campaign finance for President Trump and his campaign, or co-chair, is Kimberly Guilfoyle, who is the consort of Donald Trump Jr. Well, the New Yorker magazine, Jane Mayer, who exposed the Koch brothers, has exposed the fact that Fox News had to pay $4 million because she was going around when she worked there showing dick pics to women constantly and saying, whose do you think this is? I mean, she's a very vile person. No wonder she goes out with Donald Trump Jr., but $4 million.
Crude, very crude. Well, that just makes her very close to her, purported father-in-law, the president. It's right. His kind of activity.
Right.
All right, can we get our heads out of this mess and get on something a little more? And
some good news. Tell them what happened in San Diego.
Well, it's quite fascinating. There's a guy named Landon Donovan who was a star soccer player for many years, controversial, a little rough around the edges. But he is now the coach of a professional soccer team, not in the premier soccer league in the U.S., but the sort of second tier soccer league, the United Soccer League, USL. And he's the coach of the San Diego Loyal. That's the name of the team. So a couple of weeks ago, they had an incident where one of their players was the subject of a racist slur by another team. And they got very upset and unhappy about that. But they didn't follow through in ways that made them feel good. So they adopted a slogan that we will act. And they posted this in their stadium. And a week later, they're playing the Phoenix team in the league. And this game's important for them advancing to the playoffs or whatever. And they have an out gay player,
Colin Martin. We have a picture of him, and I think he's the only out player in the league.
Well, he was the first, I think, to come out as an active major league player.
Yep.
Across
the board. First out player in one of the big five American sports leagues.
So he was, it turned out, called Botty Boy, which is Jamaican for fag, in the midst of this game, San Diego versus Phoenix.
By a Jamaican midfielder, what's his name? Junior Fleming, who denies this charge, but everybody else seems to have heard it.
Well, they got into a hassle, and the refs red-carded Colin Martin, the gay guy on the San Diego team, holding him responsible for the fracas. And so Landon Donovan, his coach, comes out and objects and says, no, he was slurred, blah, blah. The other coach, the coach of the Phoenix team, says, "Oh, come on, we're just playing soccer. What's wrong with you?" And the ref says, "Well, I don't know what it means, so I can't call a foul on the Phoenix player because, you know, this is all new to me."
Google it.
So Landon Donovan, the San Diego coach, says, "Well, look, we made a mistake last week when we didn't do more about the racist slur, and we are not going to do that again. We are standing up. We said we would act. We are going to act." And he took the team off the field and forfeited the game.
Well, they voted to do it. I mean, the players voted to do it.
Yep.
They were winning 3-1. This was an important game, and they left.
And I think it may have taken them out of the playoffs. Right. But Landon Donovan was interviewed after the game about this, and he spoke about how important this was to him and the team and just the world in general. And his statement was so eloquent that we wanted to show it to you and let you hear everything he had to say.
About 4 minutes.
We've been through a lot in the last week. This club, our players, the organization has been through a lot in the last week. And I understand that most people watching from afar probably don't really get it, but we've been living it. And so went through a really hard incident last week in the LA match. And we made a vow to ourselves, to our community, to our players, to the club, to USL, that we would not stand for bigotry, homophobic slurs, things that don't belong in our game. And so much so that on our signboards, we made a statement saying, "I will act, I will speak." Right, so if something happens, I'm going to speak about it and I'm going to act about it. Because last week, our one regret was we should have done something in the moment when Elijah was racially abused. And that was our regret. From our players, from me, I wish we would have done something. And had we known what had happened, I think we would have done something. So we also agreed with Phoenix before the game. Our players reached out to their players and said in the 71st minute, which was the minute that it happened to Elijah last week, we were going to stop the game. We were going to hold a banner together that said, "I will act, I will speak, I will act." Because we don't want to just talk about it. We actually want to do it, and we wanted to send a message. So in the end of the first half, Colin came over to the fourth official after, crazily somehow, he got red carded, and told the fourth official that he had been abused by a homophobic slur by one of their players. And when I heard that, I lost it, because I know what this team has gone through. I know how hard it was for them to even take the field tonight, given everything that happened. And then for it to happen again a week later was just devastating for me. So it was a really difficult, probably 20 minutes, because our players, in the heart of the moment and the passion of the moment, still wanted to play. I mean, they were kicking Phoenix's ass, right? And that's a great feeling as a soccer player. But if we want to be true to who we are as a club, we have to speak and we have to act. So after halftime, we all decided that if the player who used the homophobic slur was not removed from the game, either through the officials or through their coach, that we were not going to play. Because if they're not willing to act, then we have to act. We have no choice. I asked the referee to do something about it. He said he couldn't. He said he heard the word. He knew the word was said, but he didn't know what it means. He doesn't know what that means. So he couldn't interpret it, and he didn't want to send him off because he doesn't know what the word means. Fair enough. I can understand that. If you don't speak another language, he doesn't speak whatever that was, Jamaican, then that's fine. I also then went to their coach and said, "I just want to be really clear on this. We've had a really hard week." He and I talked about it before the game, about how much we've been through. And I just said, "If you don't pull the player off the field, if you don't sub him off, our players are not going to play because we have to make a stand. So either you do it or else we're going to have to do it." And he said, "I'm not going to sub him off the field." I said, "Okay, that's fair. That's your choice." And then our guys, to their immense credit, just said, we're not going to stand for this. They were very clear in that moment that they were giving up all hopes of making the playoffs, even though they were beating one of the best teams in the league, handedly. But they said it doesn't matter. There's things more important in life, and we have to stick up for what we believe in. And so they made the decision to walk off, and I have tremendous pride in this group, and I'm really proud of this organization that I get to be a part of it.
Amazing.
Thank you, Coach.
Really amazing, really admirable, and a lesson for everybody. I wish the whole world could hear that and understand those values and that decision making.
And in other good news, in California, Governor Newsom has nominated Justice Martin Jenkins, who's 66 years old, as an associate justice of the state high court. He would be the first out gay Supreme Court justice in the state. And the third African-American man. And I was alarmed to read that they've had two others, but hasn't been one for 29 years.
Terrible.
So, but he sounds like a good guy, even though he worked for the Reagan Justice Department. He's a Democrat, but he worked for the Reagan Justice Department and did a lot of good civil rights work.
Well, let's see if he gets this case. Judicial Watch, a right-wing group, and is bringing a lawsuit in California challenging a new law that requires that corporations that are public companies include underrepresented groups, including by race, gender, sexual orientation, on their corporate boards. The right wing doesn't like that.
Well, let's go to West Virginia, where the state delegate there, John Mant Jr., has resigned over viciously anti-gay Facebook chats that he was having. Silly faggot, he wrote, dicks are for chicks. These are the kinds of things he wrote. He referred to the gay LGBT rights bill as the queer bill. He tried to deny it at first. And he also said, you know, my daughter's lost a lot of friends because of my positions on things like this. But when family turns on me, they aren't family. Your daughter. So he has resigned. There's a pic. We have a picture of him there with Don Jr. He was making a number of appearances this week.
Exactly. Well, the Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton, is under attack by his staff, which is asking him to resign because he's such a monster. We talk about him frequently. He is still awaiting prosecution on securities fraud. He was indicted years ago, and the state is just not following through on the prosecution. It's like Trump, who ignores every court ruling against him. These guys are just totally treasonous and illegal monsters.
Now, Cal Cunningham in North Carolina is not treasonous. He's the Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate against Tom Tillis, who has the virus now. He was cruising to victory, 12 points up, and then a sexting scandal has emerged. Sexting to a woman, not his wife, and, you know, God bless it, men.
If you're going to run for office, please think ahead.
Please.
This stuff is going to catch up with you.
Out Governor Jared Polis in Colorado will mass pardon anyone convicted in a state court of low-level marijuana possession. That's 2,732 people. It's automatic. You don't have to apply for it.
And the mayor of Louisville has signed the conversion therapy ban for minors. That's a good thing. And New York City Comptroller Scott Stringer wants schools to be made better for non-binary and gender non-conforming.
Please.
I think we get to.
Okay. All right. Some awful news about what's happening to trans women of color across the country. The first one we have is Mia Green, 29 years old, trans woman murdered in Philadelphia. She was the 29th this year on September 28th. Then it was
shot dead by her boyfriend in the car. He was stopped for a stop sign violation or something. And there she is dying of his gunshot wound.
And then in Georgia, Felicia Harris shot to death in Augusta, Georgia. She's an interior decorator, 33 years old. Her body was found on Saturday in Meadowbrook Park. It is a homicide. and she was the 31st victim. And then in Puerto Rico, Michelin Ramos Vargas, 33 years old, trans woman murdered, found along a highway in San Germán, shot several times. It's being investigated as a hate crime. This is a horrible litany, but wow.
Sixth in Puerto Rico this year. In Puerto Rico this year, sixth, and 30th in the U.S. this year. And a little better news, another trans woman in Los Angeles, Daniela Hernandez, 42, an immigrant from El Salvador. She was attacked by a group of men in a park and brutally stabbed, but she's not dead. She's recovering. That's the best we can do in terms of better news on that terrible, terrible epidemic of murders of trans women.
In Virginia, Amy Coney Barrett's group, the Alliance Defending Freedom, is suing the state over their new LGBT protections, saying religious people need to be able to discriminate against gay and trans people.
But in San Francisco, we're trying to preserve Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon's house. Developers want to knock it down or whatever for...
Well, they want to, yeah, they want to put up... It was a cottage, and, you know, they somebody bought it for...
Lovely cottage.
Somebody bought it for $2.25 million, and it's a double lot. And so the preservationists and the Board of Supervisors are trying to preserve it. This was they lived there from 1955 until Phyllis died in April.
And, of course, the home of a lot of meetings of the Daughters of Bilitis and other activist groups.
Make it a museum.
Yeah. All right. International news.
Yes. Belgium. They've given us our first out transgender government minister in Europe. She is Petra de Sutter, the new deputy prime minister under the new prime minister, Alexander De Croo. She's in the Green Party. She's a gynecologist or teaches gynecology, and she's going to oversee public administration and public enterprises.
She is one of seven deputy prime ministers in Belgium.
This is a country that had an out gay prime minister a few years ago.
And activism in Russia to celebrate Vladimir Putin's birthday, and Andy's got a birthday coming up, in Moscow, Pussy Riot hung a number of rainbow flags on government buildings. A nice celebration.
I don't want anything for my birthday, but we have learned that we are allowed to say to you on this show, if you would like to support Gay USA by making a donation, go to our website at gayusatv.org, and you can do that. A lot of you have done that over the years, but we didn't think we were allowed to tell you this on the show, but we learned that we are, because we are a 501c3 organization, and they are tax deductible, and we need a few bucks to keep going.
We're a frugal bunch who do the show on a shoestring, but every little bit helps, and we do appreciate it.
Okay.
In Canada, the parliament is going to try again to ban conversion therapy nationally. COVID shut down a previous try, and the proposal has criminal penalties for trying to practice conversion therapy. We'll see where that goes.
In Egypt, Human Rights Watch has a report that says LGBTQ people are being arrested and tortured in systemic fashion. It's sort of becoming another Chechnya.
And in Panama, the courts are refusing to decide marriage cases put before them. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights ordered Central and South American countries to legalize same-sex marriage several years ago, but a lot of countries are balking. They're going to take it up again to see if there's anything they can do to make it happen there and elsewhere.
And I'm reluctant to do this story, but out of the Netherlands, you know, a lot of 400 people from Uganda have applied for asylum in the past 4 years. 200 say that they're gay. And there is a report that a lot of them are being coached to just say you're gay. Now, of course, there's real horrible anti-gay discrimination all over the world, and it would be a shame if this happened. I mean, you know, people used to say they were gay to get out of the Vietnam War if they could, and they stop doing that. So, but this is apparently being done by a network of people being smuggled in. And so the fraud is under investigation.
Well, there's also a statement by an asylum lawyer who says that is overblown, and these are real cases. So we'll keep an eye on it.
Right.
Entertainment news.
All right.
Well, I'm really happy for Jackie Woodson.
She's a MacArthur genius now.
Yes. National Book Award winner, celebrated author, out lesbian, terrific human being. She's also involved in the creation of something called Baldwin for the Arts, which is an upstate arts colony for people of color, free fellowships for 2 to 8 weeks. Baldwin for the Arts, if you want to check that out.
I have a correction from last week from viewer Zachary. I said that Dan Levy's character on Schitt's Creek is gay. Dan is gay, the actor. His character, David Rose, is pansexual. Supposedly the first pansexual depicted on television.
And we're very excited about NewFest, the LGBT film festival in New York, much of which will be available online starting October 16th. They're going to do a special event, an all-trans actors Brokeback Mountain screenplay table read. That's just one of the special events at NewFest. And they're opening the festival with Ammonite, the new Kate Winslet, Saoirse Ronan lesbian sort of period drama fantasy. NewFest.org. Check that out.
I went to an online preview of the David Hockney exhibit at the Morgan Library. You can go to themorgan.org to see this. And they have a lot of, you can go to the museum now. I don't know how up I am for that. But you can go online and they have a lot of seminars about David Hockney's work. We have this first picture that he did when he was a student. It's called Drawing from Life, and I recommend it.
And a little news item about, for those of you who are fans of this kind of movie, I'm not, but whatever. The Craft has a sequel coming out, The Craft : Legacy, starring Latina trans Zoe.
Huna.
She's playing Lourdes, a 17-year-old punk rocker. There's evidently a group of four stars of this operation.
It's about teens who turn into witches. Yeah. And it was a big cult hit back in 1996, and this is the reboot of it, The Craft Legacy. We're down to our last minute.
Enjoy. What do we fill out the census, register to vote, try to convince everyone to go out and vote in whatever way, by mail, in person, early. I'm going to vote early in person, but I've filled out my absentee ballot in case I get there and the lines are too long or the crowd is too big. I can drop
it. I mailed mine in and it has been received because you can track it online.
Yeah, but it hasn't been counted yet in New York.
But it's been approved.
But really, we have a month to go. Hang in there. We can do this. And
I'm wrung out. It was a very long week.
Yeah. But keep coming back to Gay USA. We will see you next week.
And check us out at gayusatv.org. And you can sign up for our email list as well as donating.
Yeah. So we'll alert you every week to the show and what's coming up on it.
Bye-bye.
Bye.